From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Whenever it's early twilight, I watch till the star breaks through. Funny, it's not a star I see, it's always you.
That's Susie Arioli, a jazz singer who's got a big following in Canada, where she's from, but gets far too little recognition in the States. Today, we listen back to the in-studio concert Arioli recorded for us last August. Also, David Edelstein reviews Life of Pi, the new film from director Ang Lee, and Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new 50th anniversary Blu-ray edition of the classic thriller Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Don't you think I know everything that goes on in this house?
You've been spying on me.
What do you think? You are disgusting.
That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I had been waiting for years to hear singer Susie Arioli perform in concert, ever since I heard her 2002 album of swing songs and standards, Pennies from Heaven. She's Canadian, and although she has a big following there, she doesn't perform much in the States. So, tired of waiting, I set up a concert for her on our show. Today we're going to listen back to that performance, which was recorded last August. Susie Arioli made her first album in 2001. One of her albums went gold in Canada, and so did a CD-DVD of one of her concerts. Her Fresh Air concert was recorded at the CBC in Montreal. Joining her were Jordan Officer, the guitarist she always plays with, and bass player Frederick Grenier.
One, two, three, four.
It's early twilight. I watch till the star breaks through. Funny, it's not a star I see. It's always you. Whenever I roam through roses, and lately I often do. Funny, it's not a rose I touch. It's always you. If a breeze caresses me, it's really you passing by. If I hear a melody, it's merely the way you sigh. Wherever you are, you're near me. You dare me to be untrue. I fall in love, it's always you.
Susie Arioli singing for us. I neglected to mention that she's also playing snare with Jordan Officer on guitar and Fred Grenier bass, a song that many of us associate with Chet Baker. Susie, I'm tempted to ask you to actually do a Chet Baker imitation and just see, what was it that you were imitating when you were trying to get what is the essence of Chet Baker?
Well, one thing he does is he holds his notes super long, my funny Valentine. Sorry, Chet, but that thing, that's how I was singing it at the beginning. And I was like, oh my God, you can't hold the note so long, Susie. You're not Chet Baker. He's got his own brain happening, his own heart, his own way, context. But I guess I had to go through those steps of completely trying to imitate him. I mean, to me, when I was trying to completely imitate him, I sounded cold. I sounded detached from the song. I just didn't sound like me. And it's important to not do that, I think. You might as well sound like yourself, you know? But I think that's one of the main things is an incredible tone, just like his trumpet playing, I found. It was almost like an extension, just that tone, and I don't know how he breathed. Maybe he breathed through his ears or something, but that dude could sing.
And the music that you play is, largely standards from maybe the 30s on up with some country as well. How did you gravitate to that repertoire?
I found that, like, singing in my life, I remember one time, I guess when I was about kind of just about to get out of high school, I figured that jazz was available to singers. Do you know what I mean? Like, the jazz tome is open to interpretation. So as a singer, as a musician, we've all got the capacity to look at these jazz songs. Whereas if you're doing pop, pop is a bit more associated with every artist who has that song. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to, I wasn't writing, and I didn't want to have to imitate completely the pop song, or else it would sound crappy. You know, like, at the time anyway, I just thought, well, as a singer, not only are the songs incredible in jazz, but that's what I'm supposed to do. I don't know. I just thought it was logical, like, incredible music, and it's all about how it's okay for different people to do it. And so that's what I just thought. And plus, I don't know, I think that's the main reason, is I just thought that's what I was supposed to if I love singing, you know?
It makes sense to me. Well, Jordan, I want to hear more about your guitar playing, but first I'd love for you to do another song. So let me recommend one that you also do on your new album. And this is When Your Lover Has Gone, and you do the verse on this. It's a terrific verse. Susie, do you want to say why you chose this? Or Jordan, if you're the one who chose it, explain why?
I don't know why I chose this song.
I think because you liked it.
Probably because I liked it. That's kind of why people sing songs, sure.
Oh, that's too
simple. I hated it, so I figured.
There were many songs that were the first ones that made sense, that kind of defined what this new record was going to be, and that's sort of one of the later ones that we just came upon when we were just going through standards and kind of remembered that song, and oh, yeah, that's a really beautiful song, too.
So when Ray you Charles's say what defined what the record was going to be, what was the definition?
Well, we kind of were moving away from a more of a swing idiom, which we love. And we were just, I actually wanted to sound a little more modern. I wanted to try and do more of a modern jazz, not contemporary, of course, but modern. There's all these people that I admire, and I wasn't like Chet Baker. I could never really do Chet Baker's song in the swing form, you know? It didn't sound at all rational. And I also wanted to play with different musicians because swing music is a bit more hothouse flower, you know? It's a very contained, small vocabulary, whereas bebop, a lot more people know that language and can play. And I feel like as a musician, I would like to be able to play with other human beings, you know? Not just my band, you know what I mean? So it kind of opened us, I'm hoping to, and even now, like, we're playing with different musicians, like Fred, he ain't no swing guy, and we can communicate on this level, which kind of makes me a happier musician that I can play with different people.
Okay. So maybe you can do When Your Lover Has Gone for us.
Cool. A real modern song.
What good is the dreaming, the planning and scheming that comes with each new love affair? The dreams that we cherish so often may perish like castles in the air. When you're alone, who cares for starlit skies? When you're alone, the magic moonlight dies at break of dawn. There is no sunrise when your lover is gone. What lonely hours the evening shadows bring. What lonely hours with memories lingering like faded flowers. Life can't mean anything when your lover is gone.
That's Susie Arioli on vocals and drum, Jordan Officer guitar, Fred Grenier bass, and they're at the CBC in Montreal performing for us, and the first two songs that they did are from their new album, All the Way. And Susie, you were talking about how the repertoire of the band is changing, moving more from swing songs to more modern songs. Jordan, what has that meant for you in terms of what you're playing on guitar?
Well, the more swing aspect, like side of like approach that we had before, fit very easily with my playing because I have a lot of blues and country influence in my playing, and so it was more similar to that kind of swing language than more modern jazz. But over the years playing with Susie, I've just discovered more and more jazz, becoming more and more a fan of it. I also studied a couple of years at McGill in the jazz program, and I just got to like all of it more and more. So it was just a great challenge to try to go and get some of that more modern language, like Kenny Burrell and Wes Montgomery and other guitar players that I really loved, but who have been less of an obvious influence in my playing.
Now, early on, your playing was like especially influenced by Django Reinhardt. Can you play a little bit of what you learned from listening to him?
Well, there's some obvious things like certain little figures that I like to do, like. Stuff like that. I really like his tremolo playing. He has a great tremolo, but mostly it's his attitude that I really loved. I've never been one of those kind of Django players that plays really that style, but he just has a great attitude, like a crazy monster with a huge heart. And Coleman Hawkins makes me think of that too. Like he's got this huge technique and monstrous approach, but so much soul and heart and beauty in what he does. And so I really like that personality of his.
We're listening to a concert and interview with Susie Arioli, along with guitarist Jordan Officer and bass player Frederick Grenier. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a performance with jazz singer Susie Arioli, guitarist Jordan Officer, and bass player Frederick Grenier. Arioli's latest album is called All the Way. I asked them to do a song she sang on an earlier album, a song often associated with Ray Charles, You Don't Know Me.
Chance that you might love me too.
you give your hand to me, and then you say goodbye. I watch you walk away beside that lucky girl you'll never, never know, the one who loves you so. Well, you don't know me.
Oh, it was beautiful.
Thanks.
Susie, sometimes like you sing myself. Just like you're sighing. It's just so, so lovely.
Thanks.
So we just heard performing at the CBC in Montreal. That's Susie Arioli on vocal and snare. Jordan Officer on guitar with Fred Grenier bass. And they did that song on an earlier album, but their new album is called All the Way. So I have another request. And this is something from your next to the last album. And the song is called Can't We Be Friends? And before you sing it, tell us how you first learned the song, how you first heard it.
Good question. It's probably a Frankie.
I think so.
I think it's a Frank Sinatra. You know, I'm always, there's a lot of songs out there, Terry, and I always try to find the ones that, you know, you try to find the songs that you resonate with at the time or that has words that come out of your mouth well. I mean, I like the sentiment. I like the mood. I like the slyness of Can't We Be Friends and the mock, you know, mock sadness and stuff. And it's fun to perform because I get to do googly eyes at people in the audience. And it's dramatic. And, I mean, it's hard to tell, you know, if I like the story. I mean, a lot of songs, like, they have interesting stories. They're not just... they're not boring. What can I say? I like the story.
So Bing Crosby recorded this, I think, in the 1930s. Mm. So the song goes pretty far back. How contemporary do you do it?
Well, I find that a lot of the jazz songs, like even the modern songs, they were written a long time ago. Like we were almost going to put a song that was sung by Sarah Vaughan, pardon me. And which one was it? It was
Say It Isn't So.
Say It Isn't So. And the original version of Say It Isn't So is so chipper. And then I have two versions of her. One of them, I guess, is earlier and is a bit chipper. And another one is her just stretching it so dramatically. And you say to yourself, how could it have been done any different? It's incredible, you know?
That's an old Irving Berlin song.
Indeed. And it's like, say it isn't so, say it isn't so. And she's like... say it isn't so. She finds an aspect to it. And I think that's what's so wonderful about music. You can just find something. It doesn't have to be like fabulously unique, but something meaningful and resonating. And then as soon as you do it, it's contemporary. You know what I mean? I think we have to be allowed, I guess we have to be allowed to sing these beautiful songs and be contemporary with them, you know? Because they're just too good to say, oh, well, they're old. They must die now. It's like, really? It brings so much happiness to me to sing them, you know? And I would hope that children, when they're older, would sing them. I mean, if somebody stopped singing these songs, it'd be pretty sad, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so Can't We Be Friends for us?
All righty. I took each word he said as gospel truth. Like any silly child would. I can't excuse it on the grounds of youth. I was no babe in the wild, wild woods. He didn't mean it, I should have seen it. But now it's too late. I thought I met the man of my dreams. Now it seems this is how the story ends. He's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends? I thought for once I couldn't go wrong. Not for long. I can see the way this ends. He's gonna turn me
down and say, can't we be friends? Why should I care? Though he showed me the air, why should I cry, heave a sigh, and wonder why, and wonder why? I thought I met a man I could trust. What a bust. I can see the way this sends. He's gonna let me down and say, can't we be friends?
That's great. I'm so glad you do the verse on that, because the verse is so like high drama.
I know.
And the song itself is so, you know, kind of like swinging and jaunty.
We love those paradoxes.
Susie Arioli, along with guitarist Jordan Officer and bass player Frederick Renier. They joined us for an in-studio concert last August from the CBC in Montreal. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Celebrating Fresh Air's 25 years, the Neubauer Family Foundation salutes WHYY and listeners like you, committed to new ideas and civilized conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Focus Features with Anna Karenina, from the director of Atonement and Pride and Prejudice, and starring Keira Knightley, in select theaters now. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business at Yeshiva University at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Life of Pi, the new film directed by Ang Lee, based on the best-selling novel. Critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new 50th anniversary Blu-ray release of the thriller Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. He says this strange and brilliant movie is worth seeing again. And we'll hear more of our concert with Susie Arioli. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview and concert with singer Susie Arioli, guitarist Jordan Officer, and bass player Frederick Renier. They joined us from the CBC in Montreal last August. Arioli and Officer made their first album together in 2001. They perform swing songs and jazz standards, as well as some rock and country songs. Their latest album is called All the Way. How did you start off playing drums in addition to singing?
Well, I started playing the snare with my sister when she was writing songs, and I was always harmonizing with her because she's a soprano, and I would be playing my thigh, you know. And she said, you know, my boyfriend's son has a, I think he has a snare in the closet there and a couple of, you know, very gnarly-looking brushes. And when I finally met Jordan and started to play, indeed, we had another drummer. But we wanted to keep it intimate, you know, and we found that if I played the snare, it could really control the dynamics a lot. And you can get really quiet and really loud. And we wouldn't have to be like, it was just easier at the time. Plus, for me to just play, it made the sound a lot more direct and clear. It was nice for me. I love playing the snare. I love having something to do on stage with the other while the music's happening when I'm not singing. It's very exciting for me. Plus, the role that I'm playing tempo-wise and trying to find communion with the bass player is, while the guitar has his own thing going on, is very important to me and it makes me feel really good. I really enjoy it.
It's probably hard for a singer on stage when they break and everybody takes a solo, as is so often the case in jazz concerts. And I think the singer has to stand by the mic looking after solo, like, wow, that's the best solo I've ever heard.
I know. Indeed, that's true, right? You're not going to stand there looking bored, right? Of course. Even if you're not bored, there would have to be some animation. Anyway, for me personally, I love the fact that I can do that, and I recommend it to all singers who can't find a drummer, who are irritated with their drummer, to just get a snare and do it, you know?
So, Susie and Jordan, for several years, you were a couple in addition to being musical partners, and now you're just musical partners?
Mm-hmm.
So has that changed the dynamic of playing together? Like, was there a period where you thought, well, if you're not going to be a couple, then you can't play together either? I mean, I'm sure glad your music relationship didn't break up.
Yeah, well, I don't know if we considered not playing together. We kind of have a vocabulary for playing together, which is strong, which may have been the main thing. And the couple thing was kind of like, well, you know how sometimes you feel like you should be a couple? Like maybe we weren't even destined to be a couple. We were just in a band. But as is the want of a singer and a guitarist, you start hanging out together. But, you know, it's an intimate relationship. It's changed some of the things, but I think we have we'd made a bunch of records together, and that's pretty solid. What do you think there?
Well, I think the question came up, and when we recorded Nightlights, it just worked, and it worked really well, and we didn't want to stop. So that confirmed it for us, I think.
Yeah.
And the tour went great, and then it just continued, and it's been it's worked out.
So you guys are pretty well known in Canada, and you've been nominated for Junos, which is the Canadian equivalent of the Grammy. One of your albums went gold in Canada, whereas in the United States you are not very well known. And I hope to do my part to change that just a little bit. But is it hard for you when you're performing in the States? Like, you're used to, like, sold-out crowds in Canada, and you come here and, like, not that many people know who you are. Is that discouraging?
Well, what we did to remedy that was find a lovely record label named Jazz Heads and put a record out there. So they were happy to distribute us and actually be our record company in the United States, which I think is what we should have done a long time ago, but it's obviously we're going to be less known in the States if we're, you know what I mean, if we don't even have a record out there. So I think that was kind of a reason that it was hard. And I think hopefully this will make a difference, because, I mean, I have a big part of my life is stateside. I have family there. I got a history there. And I love going there. It's a big country. We have to go there. So I think this is something that we try to do to make it. I mean, we have tons of fans on the internet. I get these beautiful letters from people in Florida and Pennsylvania and, you know, any old place where people like music, and there's still jazz shows, so I guess the DJs like us and they play us. And so I'm hoping that we'll get, because of putting the record out there, that we'll have more opportunity to visit and just have a presence there.
Well, let's end with another song. And maybe you could do the title track from your new album, All the Way, and tell us, I mean, Frank Sinatra owns the song. I'm not saying that you don't. I'm just saying, like, I was going to ask you, well, why? How do you know the song? Obviously, you must know it through Frank Sinatra. But why did you decide to do it?
Well, I did love the version of Frank Sinatra. And then I think what may have clinched it is Harry Connick Jr., you know, Dreamboat. Lovely. And he does a lovely version of it, too. One thing I like to do is, if I notice that not very many women are singing the song, I like to do that. I like to give it a different perspective, you know? It's a different vibe. And I enjoy that little bit of theater that you can put into a little bit of theater that you can put into a song. You know, like those are basically known male singers, but I don't know. It's such a classic, and I really did want to put some classic jazz songs that everybody knew on this record, just to kind of not be so obscure all the time. We also like to find the obscure songs, you know. But it's also nice because, I mean, a lot of the well-known songs are just stunning, you know. And I figured I might be able to do it this time, and I hope that people like it. I guess you like it, so that's good.
Yes. All right. So here we go. This is performing for us in Montreal at the CBC studio there. We have Susie Arioli, voice and snare, Jordan Officer, guitar, and Fred Grenier, bass.
Okay. When somebody loves you, it's no good unless they love you. All the way. Happy to be near you when you need someone to cheer you. All the way. Taller than the tallest trees. That's how it's got to be. Deeper than the deep blue seas. That's how deep it goes. If it's real. When somebody needs you, it's no good unless they need you. All the way. Through the good early years and all the in-between years. Come what may. Who knows where the road will lead us. Only a fool would say. But if you let me love you, it's for sure I'm gonna love you. All the way.
Well, I want to thank all of you for performing for us. Susie Arioli, voice and snare, Jordan Officer, guitar, Fred Grenier, bass. Thank you all. I wish you the best, and very generous of you to sing and play for us today.
Thank you, Terry. It's so wonderful talking to you again, and we really appreciate this. This is wonderful.
Well, I love your music, thank you. So thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Thank you. Susie Arioli's latest album, featuring guitarist Jordan Officer, is called All the Way. They and bass player Frédéric Grenier joined us from the CBC in Montreal. Our concert was recorded last August. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new 50th anniversary Blu-ray edition of the classic thriller Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. This is Fresh Air. On the occasion of its 50th anniversary, Robert Aldrich's classic horror film Whatever Happened to Baby Jane has been released on Blu-ray. Though it's far from a musical, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says its musical elements are crucial to the film. Here's Lloyd's review.
Baby Jane Hudson is now 50 years old, or at least the strange and brilliant movie in which she's the main character, just released as a beautifully remastered Blu-ray. Robert Aldrich's grotesque gothic tragedy is a cross between Gypsy, with its antithetical showbiz kid sisters, and Sunset Boulevard, with its decayed Hollywood glamour. Baby Jane is a blonde, curly-haired child star, a Shirley Temple wannabe, like Baby June in Gypsy. She's self-centered and more selfish than her plain sister, Blanche, who in the 1930s becomes a queen of Hollywood melodrama. Then it seems as if Jane, in a sudden fit of drunken jealousy, has rammed her car into her sister and crippled her for life. Years later, the sisters are still living together in a nightmare of mutually destructive codependency. Director Aldrich is no stranger to movies about Hollywood or the grotesque. His best-known works, including Kiss Me Deadly, The Dirty Dozen, and The Longest Yard, range from film noir and horror to biblical epic and archetypal action films. But the reason audiences crowded to see Baby Jane was probably not the director, but its two legendary stars, Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, in the first and last film they ever made together. There was evidently as little love lost between the actresses as between the sisters.
Don't you think I know everything that goes on in this house?
You've been spying on me.
What do you think? You are disgusting. After all I've done for you, you spy on me, when all I'm trying to do is help. Who are you trying to help, Blanche? What are you planning to do with me when you've sold the house? What you have in mind, some nice little place where they could look after me? Tie yourself out using the phone anymore. If there are any calls, I'll take them downstairs. Eat your lunch, it'll get cold.
50 years after its premiere, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane still holds up, both for its vivid direction and its fascinating performances. Joan Crawford, as the trapped and suffering Blanche Hudson, is both convincing and quite sympathetic as the victimized sister, a more surprisingly understated performance than I remembered. We don't discover until the very end of the movie what a monster she really is. Bette Davis, of course, has the more bravura role, the child star who wants to make a comeback as an adult, but who's still living in her childhood. Guilty and tormented because she thinks she's caused her sister's injury, she tortures her sister and even commits a murder, yet her derangement also allows her to retain her childlike innocence. Part of the movie is a kind of musical. Baby Jane becomes a star singing an awful sentimental ballad, "I've written a letter to Daddy, his address is heaven above." Written by Frank Duvall and Bob Merrill, who wrote the lyrics for Funny Girl and such 50s novelty hits as If I Knew You Were Coming, I'd Have Baked a Cake and How Much Is That Doggy in the Window, it's a skillful parody of old music hall songs. Jane sings the song again as a grown-up when she's making her pathetic attempt to revive her career. It's a moment both repugnant and perversely comic.
I've written a letter to Daddy. His address is heaven above. I've written, dear Daddy, we miss you and wish you were with us to love. Instead of a stamp, I put kisses. The postman says that's best to do. I've written a letter to Daddy saying I love you.
Finally, Jane learns the truth about what's behind her malignant relationship with her sister. Davis's performance achieves a kind of tragic grandeur, a moment before Jane's total retreat from reality, of heartbreaking, almost Oedipal illumination that she and Blanche really didn't have to wreck each other's lives.
All this time we could have been friends.
You were frightened and ran away. I managed to crawl out of the car up to the gates. When they found me, they assumed it was your fault. You were so drunk and confused, you didn't know any better. You weren't ugly then. I made you that way. I even did that.
There's a place up there that sells things. You like ice cream? I'll get you some.
In the last minutes of the film, Jane is dancing like a child on the beach, surrounded by stunned onlookers, the audience she's craved for so many years. It's one of Bette Davis's great screen moments, and she was nominated for an Oscar. Crawford wasn't. But Davis lost to Anne Bancroft in The Miracle Worker, and Bancroft's Oscar was accepted by none other than Joan Crawford. Ah, Hollywood. But the weirdest moment on the new Blu-ray is not part of the movie. It's a bonus track of an appearance by Bette Davis on the late Andy Williams TV show, singing a rock song called Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Few horrors in the film itself are as scary as this clip.
Whatever happened to Baby Jane? She could dance, she could sing, make the biggest theater ring. Jane could do most anything. Whatever happened to Baby Jane? Whatever happened to Baby Jane? When she'd walk down the street, all the world was lying at her feet. There was no one half as sweet. Whatever happened to Baby Jane? I see her old movies on TV, and they are always a thrill to me. My daddy says I can be just like her. How I wish, I wish, I wish, I wish I were. Whatever happened to Baby Jane? To her smile.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Phoenix and teaches in the Creative Writing MFA program at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He reviewed the new 50th anniversary Blu-ray edition of Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Life of Pi, the new film directed by Ang Lee. This is Fresh Air. The new movie Life of Pi is adapted from the 2001 best-selling novel by Jan Martel. Told mostly in flashback, it's about an Indian boy who survives a shipwreck and is lost at sea, adrift on a lifeboat with a Bengal tiger. The movie was shot in 3D. The Bengal tiger was created with computer graphics. The movie was directed by Ang Lee. David Edelstein has this review.
Ang Lee has a surprising affinity for the Indian hero of Life of Pi. That's his name, Pi, and he's seen at several ages, but principally as a 17-year-old boy adrift on a lifeboat in the South Pacific, the lone survivor of a shipwreck that killed the crew, his family, and a variety of zoo animals his father was transporting for sale to North America. Actually, Pi is the lone human survivor. He shares his boat and its dwindling food supplies with a man-eating Bengal tiger. Lee is a director whose works I've admired more than loved. All his movies, among them Sense and Sensibility, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Brokeback Mountain, even Hulk, center on emotions that bump up against rigid codes of behavior, emotions that can't be suppressed and finally erupt. Lee's range of genres and settings is impressive, but there's something about his meticulousness that keeps me at a distance. I know that many people loved Brokeback Mountain, but I got hung up on the mythical cowboy iconography, that forbidden love sanctified by purple mountain majesties. Lee makes movies about giving in to passion without seeming to let go. But Life of Pi is different. Most of the film is a flashback, a tale told to a writer by the middle-aged Pi. And the way that Lee depicts it, in a style that's typically fastidious and arty, is astonishingly in sync with his narrator. That lifeboat, in which most of the movie takes place, is a wondrous set, not realistic, but not fake either, transcendentally in between. The water is ultra-ultramarine, the sea a mirror in which clouds above seem to mingle with sharks, dorados, luminous jellyfish, even whales below. The orange of the tiger burns as bright as in William Blake's immortal poem. The 3D is brilliantly effective in creating multiple planes of reality, and it also allows Lee to hold shots for longer than any studio would let him, if not for that marvelously immersive technology. This isn't just a gorgeous survival story. The search for higher meaning runs all through the movie, as it does through Jan Martel's best-selling novel. Growing up, Pi was drawn to multiple faiths. He thanks Vishnu for introducing him to Christ, while rolling out his prayer mat to honor Allah. The kid subscribes to everything. But on that lifeboat, it seems as if none of his many gods will even acknowledge his existence. He's terribly alone, except, of course, for you-know-who. And talk about a mismatched buddy picture. Because of a bureaucratic screw-up, the tiger bears the name of the man who caught him, Richard Parker. But despite that human moniker, the beast is never anthropomorphized. For long stretches, Pi stares at the tiger with both awe and dread.
I never thought a small piece of shade could bring me so much happiness, that a pile of tools, a bucket, a knife, a pencil might become my greatest treasures, or that knowing Richard Parker was here might ever bring me peace. In times like these, I remember that he has as little experience of the real world as I do. We were both raised in a zoo by the same master. Now we've been orphaned, left to face our ultimate master together. Without Richard Parker, I would have died by now. My fear of him keeps me alert. Tending to his needs gives my life purpose.
The young actor, Suraj Sharma, has a good, wiry presence. He's alert to everything, as he needs to be. Irfan Khan, as the older Pi, has the more thankless job, largely just sitting and telling his story to a writer played by Rafe Spall. Those framing scenes are awfully clunky, but against all odds, they pay off. The movie has a sting in its tail that puts what you've seen in a startlingly harsh context. The over-controlled Ang Lee has gone with his strengths and made a movie that's passionately over-controlled. If it seems one step removed from reality, under glass, with twinkles of magic that are obviously computer-generated, well, that penchant for artifice is the key to the film. Like Pi, Lee believes with all his heart in the transformative power of storytelling. Only one thing about this lovely movie saddens me. Once upon a time, audiences would say, "Wow, how'd they do that?" Some people might read about how it was done later. Most would never find out. Now, you can't get away from the behind-the-scenes documentaries on cable and the internet. The DVD will have a raft of extras showing Richard Parker and that lifeboat at every stage of its computer generation. I wish we could just say, "Wow," and leave it at that.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science, technology, and economics in the modern world. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, celebrating National Adoption Month and promoting lifelong families for all children at aecf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Hilary Mantel talks about her best-selling historical novel, Wolf Hall, and its recent sequel, Bring Up the Bodies, about the formation of the Church of England, the reign of King Henry VIII, and the beheadings he ordered. Each book won the Man Booker Award, Britain's highest literary honor. Join us.